Welcome back. All new tonight, News Nation taking you inside hospitals across the country to show you how doctors and nurses in communities small and large are handling the pandemic. Now, 9 months into the fight, we're hearing new stories from survivors and also Americans who've lost loved ones. Our Michael Schur joins us live now for a News Nation special report. Michael, I know you've put a lot of time into this and you have a lot of miles behind you as well. You join us tonight from Florida with more on some of the hardest hit states in the country.
Joe, thanks. That's right. Yeah, we're here in Sarasota, Florida, outside Sarasota Memorial Hospital, where they have 71 COVID patients in there. And you're right, we went inside so many hospitals. We're outside tonight, but we got unique access here at News Nation to tell the stories of those who work every day. You know, we spend so much time talking about politics, talking about masks, talking about whether our kids can play sports. But as we're having those conversations in a hospital like this, they're seeing numbers triple, and these people are working tirelessly. And because of the access we got, we're able to tell the stories of those who are fighting this, the ravages of COVID, the ravages of coronavirus every day. The view of the devastation of COVID from the inside is far different of that from the outside. In a political climate consumed by masks and relief money, a look behind the intensive care curtain finds unprecedented work and camaraderie, impossible sadness, and even a little bit of hope. From Wisconsin to Iowa to North Carolina, we visited with hospital workers, families, and professionals whose lives have all been altered by the parade of illness and death, which have underscored this unforgivingly endless and endlessly unforgiving year.
I would say everything is different. Although I think we're trained to work in the hospital, we never predicted we would be in anything like this.
Dr. Ann Sheehy oversees the COVID ward at the University of Wisconsin Hospital in Madison, where not just the medicine they practice has changed, but so too has the way they practice.
We will never be the same. This has changed completely how we think about medicine. I thought about our routines, our true link to the public. I mean, really, this is what we're seeing now is directly related to the public response to this pandemic.
Moreover, the unpredictability of the virus has made medicine even more challenging, with increases in cases happening now and intensive care units like the one at the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill at near and over capacity.
So the number of ICU patients has doubled in the last 2 weeks, and the acuity of illness of those patients has gone up considerably.
I asked Dr. Shannon Carson if this scares these healthcare workers.
Well, I think it, you know, frightens our team. They've been working extremely hard on this nonstop in this state since April, and have been busy with it. And these people have been on the front lines the whole time.
News Nation was granted unusual access to those front lines where Doctors Sheehy, Carson, and their teams fight these battles. The day-to-day has changed for these doctors and nurses who spend stretches of time in the process of what they call donning and doffing, the careful putting on and taking off of protective gear called PAPR, or powered air purifying respirators that push air down so that inhalation is limited. As nurses go from room to room attending to these gravely ill patients, they do so with risks like they have never seen before. And they serve shifts on either side of a line of tape separating what this hospital calls low and high risk zones.
So currently, this is just routine care for COVID infected ICU patients with providers on close to the rooms and personal protective equipment to keep them from becoming infected. On this side of this barrier, we are a safe enough distance from the rooms where infection is very low risk, so we wear a lower level of personal protection.
But what happens on the high risk side, the face-to-face care that is given from respiratory rescue to the administration of medicine, is what brings professionals like Chapel Hill nurse Alan Fanning to work every day, even as the virus swells.
Well, we've always taken care of sick people that's all we really want to do. But I think the resources are really stressed right now. And I think we worry that we're not going to be able to provide the level of care that we've been able to provide in the past. I haven't seen that yet, but, you know, that's the worry. Yeah.
Fanning fears what healthcare workers have forecast, a further case escalation from Thanksgiving, which would be happening right now.
So, I mean, we're already planning. The hospital's already planning for what's going to happen a week or 2 weeks from now following Thanksgiving. You know, I think that's been going on since day one. There are contingency plans based on what might happen until we run out of beds.
And in Madison, Dr. Sheehy fears the same.
I would say that we need the public. Right now, the healthcare providers are doing everything they can. The amount and the volume of patients who need us in the next month is directly related to what the public decides to do.
Even at a rural hospital like this one in Newton, Iowa, the fear is similar.
You know, if the surge gets much worse, we're already kind of at our near capacity. There is no more surge that we can take. So the highest inpatient census we've had has been between 10 to 15 COVID inpatients.
Chad Kelly oversees emergency preparedness at Mercy Hospital, where the recent rise in cases is acutely felt.
We want to help, but when we're taking up with not expected illnesses, a high surge of that, you know, there is a sense of tension and a sense of urgency.
An urgency over which only so much can be done.
We are positioned 30 miles from Des Moines. We have a county of 37,000 people, and we have staff just under 200. And so by large and far, you know, our resources are relatively thin.
In rural hospitals, the COVID care is no different than anywhere. However, those resources that Kelly mentions are a challenge that every one of these hospitals across America face.
We are in Newton, Iowa, which is a smaller town. What is it that's different here than you would find at a COVID wing in Des Moines or a bigger city even?
Our job is to stabilize the patient and get them to the center where there are specialists as well, pulmonologists, neurologists, who can then take care of them. So a lot of it comes down to resources.
Perhaps the most vital of those resources in this pandemic is the ventilator, and they know that in Newton.
This would be a prime example of a standard ventilator. You know, this one isn't by any means brand new or, you know, the Cadillac, so to speak, but it works for us, and we're very thankful and grateful to have it.
Yeah, there's been about a 15 to 20% increase in flight volume.
Many of these COVID patients are so severe that they need to be transported to Des Moines via helicopter. Iowa has a sophisticated network for bringing rural patients to a hospital like Mercy in Des Moines.
We work with the tertiary facilities and transport these patients to Mercy or, you know, any other major hospital in the state that requires advanced care that they're not able to provide at the rural level. So, I mean, that's our big part of that process. So we're just one small piece of this giant puzzle in regards to managing COVID patients.
The helicopters provide relief to patients, but also to the hospitals in the more far-flung parts of the Hawkeye State.
The illness isn't, you know, benign to anybody. Anyone can get infected, regardless of geographical location. So in the rural setting where there's a smaller critical access hospital that they're limited with resources, specifically critical care needs, that's where our involvement with this management of the pandemic is critical.
Yet while all the king's horses have mobilized to fight the coronavirus, the history will be written by those who survived the ravages of the disease and those who are survived by it, like these two women who lost two different men in their lives.
We also joke that he was the guy who always knew a guy. You know, if you needed something, Josh say, oh, I know a guy, I can get that for you. So, and he was very well liked.
And that day, everything seemed to be going fine. He went home, went back to the office on Thursday. He just wasn't getting any better.
There were times when, you know, I'd call my mom and, oh, he's getting better, he's feeling better. And he went to the hospital early in the week on a Monday, because I think he was having trouble breathing.
And then he met me in the driveway as I was going to work. And he said, hey, Jemaine, what do you think? Do you think I have that COVID stuff that's going around?
They sent him home with an inhaler and then just kept going downhill and went back to the hospital on that Friday and never came out.
But his oxygenation dropped so fast. And it was unreal how a life is taken so quickly because of this nasty virus.
Sarah Muse is a school teacher in Newton, Iowa, and Jamae Wiersba, an ER nurse in Madison, Wisconsin. Both Midwesterners touched in tragic ways by the coronavirus. Sarah lost her brother, Josh Glodo, in August at 46. Jamae, her grandfather, Richard Grams, at 80 in October.
My brother was so much more than a number. He was a son. He was a dad. He was a brother, a cousin. He was a friend. He was loved by so many people. And yes, he's one person, but his death has affected so many people. Just the one person's death. It's changed my life forever. It changed the course of my life. Definitely changed the course of his daughter's life. My parents had to bury their only son.
One of the things that that company is doing is in their email signature is at the bottom they're putting remembering our gentle giant. And I think that's a really good way to explain him and to keep him in the spirit of the company.
The strain on families who can't be with their loved ones has been an unforeseen and brutal part of the pandemic.
Every day you're talking to these families and you don't have a lot to say a lot of the times because it is just time that they need.
The absence has been felt by those trying to save lives.
It's hard for them to sit there, you know, 24 hours a day worrying about their family member while, you know, we're here working and not hear from us.
And to those who deal with the end of life.
End of life is a rite of passage, and we all need to be able to support each other during that.
Pete Gunderson owns Gunderson Funeral Home in Fitchburg, Wisconsin.
Zoom has been wonderful, FaceTime has been wonderful, but we use all of our senses anytime that we're in emotional times, so that leaves out the touch.
As these stories are being told all over the country, so too are the stories of those who work so that they need not be told.
Everybody, you know, in a way, they feel like they signed up for this, you know, to take care of really, really sick people, you know. For a lot of people, this is their calling, I think. And they didn't hesitate, you know. Of course, there were a lot of difficulties along the way, and it's still very difficult, a lot of hard days.
Madison nurse Alex Martinelli has seen so much in his career, but highlights the newness of this foe.
I mean, we're all working through this together. I mean, it's a novel virus. Nobody's an expert by any means. As many people want to be experts, there aren't any.
But there are different kinds of experts in these hospitals.
To keep it simple, most people would say that we're housekeepers of the hospital. So cleaning non-patient and patient rooms, areas throughout the hospital.
Environmental services technician is the fancy title for what Jeffrey Cather does here, a vital job at hospitals everywhere.
You're not a doctor, you're not a nurse, you're not bringing medical relief, you're not curing, but you're filling another role. What is that role to you?
I feel like, you know, we don't have a role that's up here as far as people looking at it. You know, we're more down here, but what we do is the most important thing here. Because if I'm not doing the cleaning as well as my coworkers, you know, every single day, this place can't be open. Like, it's not going to be safe. It's not going to be sanitary. You wouldn't want to come here if it wasn't clean.
Responding to COVID isn't all about medicine in any hospital. Cather revels in the relief he may be able to bring to an intensive care patient.
So I like to get to know them, you know. Obviously, I know why they're here, but we talk about other things from that. So while I'm cleaning, I can take their mind off of why they're here and talk to them about their family or what they're into, what they do on the outside.
To a person, the medical professionals with whom we spoke lamented the lack of care being taken outside of the hospital walls and wished that people got to see what we saw and what they see every day.
You're making choices for other people, and you have to think about whether or not that's really fair, and would you want people making those choices for you? You know, the worst case scenario is right here. And that's nothing I wish on anybody.
I understand the freedom viewpoint, you know, of the mask wearing, but I think if we just take a step back and just say, just with like everything else, there are battles to fight. Maybe this is the one that we can just band together and help each other out.
But we really, really need people to wear masks and forego those social gatherings, even the small ones. They're just critical right now. And if we do that, our systems may avoid getting completely overwhelmed, and we're at the brink right now. We don't have any more space, and we don't have any more staff, and we're begging for the public to understand that.
Despite the background noise and those admonitions, the work of hospital staff like nurse Nicole Parrish is informed only by getting people better.
For me, I have to separate that. I feel like by the time you get to a room where I'm taking care of you, it doesn't matter to me if you're 30, 80, if you believe in COVID, if you don't, if you wore a mask, if you didn't, if you're an immigrant or a U.S. citizen, none of that matters to me at that point. I have to just separate it, and you're my patient, and I'm going to do what I can.
The day we were in Madison, the staff had placed a breathing tube in an elderly patient, a prisoner, who ironically had guards placed outside his room as other patients can't even see family.
You can feel the angst, you can feel the anxiety. They're on the phone with, you know, on FaceTime with their families saying, I love you and, you know, I hope I get to see you again. So that's the part that's like the scared part on my end. I know that we take amazing care of our patients and we're going to do everything we can to get them off of the ventilator, but, you know, it's probably a 50-50 shot once we intubate.
Odds that Georgia NAACP board member Edward DuBose knows well.
It was our anniversary, our 35th anniversary, and she was saying, happy anniversary, and I was telling her, baby, I'm sorry that I was not able to get us anything.
Words DuBose uttered from an ICU bed in Georgia.
She said, don't worry about that. We have a lot of years to go. But I was so far gone, I told her, no, I'm not going to make it this time. We won't have no more anniversary. Then she got quiet. But I had to let her know, based on where I was at, I felt that I was dying.
DuBose is an ordained elder in the church, and his faith, he says, is part of why he was in the hospital to begin with.
At the very beginning, I was one of those people who didn't believe in wearing masks. I somehow covered it behind my faith. Thinking that, you know, somehow if you are a person of faith, then the mask doesn't pertain to you.
Yes! Yes!
But if the virus tested his faith, the hospital restored it and also his health.
Every single nurse, doctor, food preparer, the people who cleaned the bathroom, not just at St. Francis Hospital, but across this country. I learned when I was in that hospital, laying on that bed, I couldn't even clean myself, that those people checked on me around the clock. I watched their stress. I watched their tears. But at the same time, I watched their joy when one person like me was saved.
Though Ed DuBose, a Georgian, wasn't one of Shannon Carson's patients, cases like his keep the North Carolina doctor optimistic in a pandemic.
We've seen patients who we never thought would pull through. We've seen them leave the hospital and know that at some point they're going to be able to return to some sense of normal life from the most severe critical illness that we've seen. So that gives us all a true sense of purpose.
And through the dark, there is also a new sense of optimism in the form of vaccines.
You know, it just happens to be a lot of resources piled into this vaccination, and I think that we're seeing the results of that. So no steps were skipped. Seems pretty safe. I would take it.
In fact, every medical professional we asked said that they would take the vaccine.
First chance I get, just to help me relax a little bit, at least on that aspect of it, and also to do my part as a citizen to reduce the level of potential virus in the community.
I will take the vaccine once it's offered. I think I believe in science, and I think this is what we need to get the virus under control.
For sure, of course.
Would you take the vaccine tomorrow?
I would, certainly, yeah.
Would you take a vaccine tomorrow?
100%.
There is no last word on COVID, but it was Wisconsin nurse Alex Martinelli who may have summed it up best.
I think at the end of the day, being able to disseminate to people that this is real, people are very sick, this is not something where you can only get it if you're old or immunocompromised. It's really just a roll of the dice of how it's going to affect you. So I think that we all have to do our part to protect one another because you just don't know. There is so much unknown about this.
It was certainly a privilege for our News Nation crew, Jeff Mills, photographer, Alex Rhodes, producer, to be on the road and talking with these medical professionals, learning about what their day-to-day is. And I'm joined now by Dr. James Fiorico, who's the medical director here at Sarasota Memorial. Doctor, when I talked to these people and these other hospitals, it was in anticipation of the Thanksgiving surge. You're feeling that now, though, aren't you?
Yes, we sure are. We're starting to see those numbers rise, and it is a concern.
And when you see those numbers rise, and then you hear about the vaccine, right? What does that do? I mean, we're going into a holiday season. You saw two people and then many more in the United Kingdom take that vaccine. What does that do for you and your team here?
It brings us hope. It really brings us hope. You know, we all have fatigue. Everybody's tired. But it gives us a chance to say we're on this final surge so we can get beyond this and get everybody vaccinated.
Final is a great word to hear from you, Doctor. Thanks so much. And finally, we say goodnight to you from Sarasota Memorial Hospital and send it back to Chicago.
Michael, quick question for you. You've seen the numbers. We've all seen the numbers. We've all seen the reports. You actually got a front row seat and were inside the hospitals. What was your big takeaway from this experience?
The takeaway, and it's almost cliche now, Joe. I mean, when you see what these people are doing there every day, giving their lives to these patients, and you heard, I think it was Nicole Parrish, the nurse there, talk about they don't think about whether they wore a mask. They don't think about whether they believe it, who they voted for last November. They don't think about that. They just want to get these people better, and they want people to behave in a way that they have to stop seeing these types of patients.
Michael, it is hard for any of us to really comprehend what these frontline healthcare workers are facing day in and day out, but I'm wondering what kind of emotional support they have when they leave the hospital. Are they getting the support and the help that they need based on what they're going through?
It's such a great question, Marnie. A lot of them, and I asked a question like that to one of them, they say, we're going to wait until afterwards. We don't have time to think now. We don't have time to sort of contend with the emotions that this brings to us. So I imagine there's going to be, one of them said, there's going to be some PTSD when this is all over. And I believe that because you see how hard they work, but they just have the blinders on and they're full speed ahead in fighting this virus.
Michael, incredible reporting. Thank you so much. You and the crew, just remarkable. Thanks. And a story that cannot be told enough. Thank you.